Thank you, Ray. I'm Ruth Jagosinski, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the 87 group in Las Vegas, Nevada. And my, this is what we call a full house in the state of Nevada. Not only is it full, it is tight. And I understand after watching you last night why there's not a lot of noise in this room, because you can't move much. And so if you rustle around and have to stand up, that's okay. I believe that speakers have a certain amount to speak and listeners have a certain amount to listen. If you finish listening before I finish speaking, that's all right. I understand that. I've been in that position. So it's okay. Certainly there is nothing like Southern hospitality. I have been hosted beautifully since I was received at the airport by your Southeast trustee, given a ride on your new MARTA, just to be sure that I'm up to date with what's going on in Atlanta. Had my daily phone call. We have some nicknames for him. He'd rather I not share them at the podium, but afterward, on a one-to-one basis, I'm available. This afternoon, Harold took me around, and I was able to see some of the sights of Atlanta that I have not seen when I was here before. And then, as Ray said, he spent a few minutes this afternoon talking with me and trying to pronounce my last name. I told him, don't worry about it. And what he could say about me, my last name is a little longer than some normal folks. I lived in Albany, Georgia for a couple of years, and I got questions like, are you a U.S. citizen? And were you born in the United States? I finally broke down and told him my maiden name was Clark, and I was okay after that. But I had trouble with Poles. I ran into them and married them, and I wouldn't even try his name until I knew him for 3 weeks, so don't feel bad if you don't try it. So Ray was asking me what he could do to make me comfortable or introduce me, and I gave him some suggestions because I'm dressed kind of casually. He didn't take my suggestion, and if you want to know what it was, you can ask Ray afterward. He listened to the local pressure rather than the out-of-town. They pointed out that it might be nice to make me happy tonight, but he was going to have to live with that other folks for many years. And he made a wise decision. And really, after we come to AA, isn't learning, at least for me, it has been a matter of learning to make new decisions, sometimes by mistake, and another decision. And before I came in here tonight, I was in my room having a last drink of water and drink of coffee, and I'm one of those that still smokes and will not get a round of applause from the militant and reformed smokers in the room. I had to make a decision then whether I should go to the bathroom one more time or not. And I think I might have made the wrong decision. In any case, when John read the 12 traditions, he told you about the tradition that says that we don't have any leaders, we only have trusted servants. I heard that misread and explained last weekend when I was in Vancouver by a speaker, and he heard somebody say that, misread that at a meeting as our leaders are but twisted servants. So I am one of your twisted servants, and I serve with Joe, and he teaches me a lot, and I have enjoyed knowing Joe very well. As I said, the hospitality has been good. Your weather is warm, but I'm used to that. I've had fun. The only problem I had last night, of course, my body was on Pacific time. Somebody referred to Nevada as the Midwest. I corrected them. That was after I'd been corrected, and I said something about being here in the East, and they said, you're not in the East, you're in the South, and apologized for that. But I felt duty-bound to correct them that Nevada was not in the Midwest, but it is on Pacific time, so there was a three-hour change, and I had a little trouble getting to sleep. I had a nightmare, and I dreamed that I had died and gone to heaven, and walked in, and St. Peter let me in, and the first person I saw was your delegate, Gay, here, and she had attached to her arm one of the ugliest baboons I have ever seen, and he was padlocked onto her arm. And I turned around to St. Peter, and I said, this can't be right. I've known this lady, and she served Alcoholics Anonymous well, and whatever she did certainly must have been made up for. And St. Peter said, well, we know some things about Gay that you may not know. And this is, her time in purgatory is 5,000 years with this baboon attached to her. Turned around, the next person I saw was Harold. And Harold had this ugly warthog attached to his leg. And I said, now I know Harold has also served Alcoholics Anonymous well, and I don't understand why he would, well, we know some things about Harold that you may not know. And for his sins, he is having to spend 5,000 years with this warthog attached to his leg. Then I turned around and I saw Joe Phelan. And he had Raquel Welch attached to his arm. And then I knew it wasn't fair. I said, I know he's been around a lot longer maybe than the others, but I don't think it's fair to rate people by just length. They've all done some good things for Alcoholics Anonymous, and certainly he couldn't have been that good before. And St. Peter said, no, you don't understand. We know some things about Raquel Welch that you don't know. But in any case, anything that you hear me say or that you might see or think about me, good or bad, is probably a result of my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened, and not too much about what I'm like now, some of it. The rest of it you can kind of draw your own conclusions. I was born and raised in New York City. And I eventually found out that I came from 100% alcoholic family. My mother died drinking alcoholic in 1968 before I, as I was just about probably in the middle of my alcoholic drinking. And my father had always been an alcoholic from my high school time on up. And I was just kind of like Larry said last night, it was uncomfortable to bring any friends home. You congregated at other people's houses. And I didn't hang around at that time with a particularly drinking crowd. There were a lot of Italians where I grew up, and to have wine with your meal was usual, and I don't remember any special use or abuse of it at that time. I also have a sister who's an alcoholic, so I don't know how, except that I kind of viewed it as we do seatbelts. You know, if I don't wear it, it's okay because it's not going to happen to me. And the career that I chose, I'm a nurse, and that's one of the decisions I probably would have made again, one of the correct decisions I made earlier in my life. So I took care of alcoholics in the terminal stage, and that was my view of an alcoholic. My parents, who were two fairly well-educated people, my mother was a nurse, my father was a lawyer, and I viewed it as that they were having a race to see who could die first, and my mother won. I had emotionally turned her off about 6 years before she died, and because she was not the mother that I knew. And I just couldn't understand. The one time my sister and I tried to approach my father or anybody, but particularly him because he seemed to have more sense and been doing it longer, to try and get some help for her, we were shot down in the water. And we were told it was a disgrace to speak about our mother that way, and he didn't want to ever hear it again in that house. And last night I think Larry said something about it's hard to hide an alcoholic. She was a good example, and many women are, particularly in that age group or that long ago. They were hidden. They were not out of the house. There were relatives that did not see her for the last 6 years of her life. She was a maintenance drinker. She maintained a telephone conversation with these people, so nobody really knew how sick she was. And when she finally went to the hospital in 1968, it was because she had fallen over in the backyard and was not able to get up by herself, and my father was too drunk to help her. And she went to the hospital and died about 3 weeks later. My sister and I being nurses, I happened to be there at the time. And she lived in upstate New York. She came down. And I'm sure that you've seen some alcoholics that don't take real good care of themselves, and they're not necessarily living on the street. And I don't think my mother had cut her toenails or her fingernails for many months, possibly a year. And the looks that my sister and I got were probably looks that I would have given any relative who had brought in an alcoholic looking like my mother did, and knowing that the two girls were both nurses. That I had just about that much understanding. But I certainly understood that I could not touch her or do for her unless she would allow me. So I didn't have a real, and her brother, who is a surgeon, had drank himself to death 10 years before. So I didn't have a real good view of what an alcoholic was. After she died in 1968, my drinking was to really, really get out of control. But back as a teenager and into nursing school, I met a fellow in the Air Force through a pen pal kind of relationship. And I'm going to tell you, some of the character defects of being an alcoholic were there real early. And I didn't know this fellow very well, except from our letters. And matter of fact, I didn't know much about the world, because he started out by telling me he was an orphan, his parents were dead, and his aunt had raised him. And I found out about 6 months later, his parents weren't dead. He was just mad at them and told me they were dead. And that's a little difficult to explain to your parents, too. And they said to me, thank you, he's not right. That was like when I was 15, my father said, you may not bleach your hair. Well, you know what I did. And they said, he's not right. And I was in lust. And so I proved them, you know, I got pregnant first and married second, which wasn't very acceptable back then. And they were right. He was wrong. And it only took me about 10 months to find out. I do have a beautiful daughter from that marriage, but the marriage certainly did not last. Two very, very immature people trying to play house at that point. However, the professional end, I thought the drought had hit the speaker's stand too. Thank you. I noticed he had some last night. I wondered, well, but I know there's more water restrictions all the time. The professional side of me was doing pretty well. I enjoyed my nursing. I got better and more responsible positions, and so that became kind of a crutch for me, because I knew I could perform well in that arena, and I did, and that increased. In any case, from New York, I moved to just the place every New Yorker wants to go to, Grand Forks, North Dakota, and mainly because it had easy divorce laws back then, and most of the states didn't, and I put my residency in, and I did have a friend there from nursing school, and that's where I met Mr. Jagosinski, who was also in the Air Force, and went on to England, and that's where our son was born. Spent 3 years over there, really enjoyed it. He was in the Air Force, requested the Northeast or the North Central for a base. We're stationed at Turner Air Force Base in Albany, Georgia. And that's where some of the partying and that kind of drinking and the looking forward to kind of drinking events came into it. In England, the drinking was certainly increasing. My ex-husband was not an alcoholic, is not as far as I know now, or even a particularly heavy drinker. And so that it wasn't like there was always drinking at our house. It was, I drank when he wasn't there or was working an odd shift kind of thing. And I don't know if any of you have been corpsmen or worked in or around military hospitals, but back in the 60s, corpsmen could reach into their pockets, come up with a variety of pretty colored things to lift your spirits or lower your spirits, and pills and drugs were not counted like they are nowadays. They were sent to us in bottles of 1,000 for us to dispense as nurses. I have no idea why I didn't get into better living through chemistry, because it certainly was available. I took some amphetamines because I could drink more. I took some amphetamines if I worked a double shift, but I really didn't get hooked on them. I found I had such a horrendous hangover after using them that I was sure it was the pills, and so I stopped the pills. Anyway, we came back to Albany, Georgia, and the drinking was increasing, but it still was not real open when he was around, and he was not a social person. We didn't go to a lot of social events. From there, again, we asked for the Northeast or the North Central. We were sent to Little Rock, Arkansas. And in Little Rock, he went to Vietnam for a year. This was in 68, as my mother, just before, he went to Vietnam just after my mother died. I had gone home, and he had come with me to kind of say goodbye before he left. And she died, and my father, like I said, they were in DTs together in the hospital, and we weren't quite sure if either one would survive. And he went off to Vietnam. My father did obviously survive, and many more years, hearty soul, some of them. Larry was saying thought his father was an alcoholic and lived his upper 80s or 90s, and I know my father put a quart away for 25, 30 years, and even though he had absolutely no liver left when he finally died in his 70s, his mid-70s, I just didn't think it was fair. That was my thought. When my trouble with drinking was becoming obvious, I thought, and this is where my thinking was, It took my mother at least 6 years to die. How come I'm getting in trouble in 3 or 4? Now, that's real, clear, sane thinking. And my father's been doing this for 25 or 30 years. How come I can't? In Arkansas, they have a spider called the brown recluse spider, and I guess it's pretty well traveled all over. Us military folks, I guess, shipped it around the country, but in any case, it's a sneaky little thing. It's not like the black widow that's out where you can see it, and I don't really know where I got bitten, whether it was in my house or in my car, but I got bitten by this spider. Never heard of it before. I know a lot more about it than I ever wanted to know now. And like a good nurse, ignored the sore red spot on my leg the next day. And as it got worse and my temperature went up and I began to get flu symptoms, I never connected it. Like a good nurse, I went across the street where I was working and got myself some cortisone and thought that would settle the inflammation down. Now, very few people are allergic to cortisone. You happen to be looking at one of them. And I broke out in these beautiful red blotches on every single joint in my body. And the leg got worse and worse. So finally, pain, it doesn't itch. It's very painful. It drove me to the doctor. He took one look. It was this, at this point, about 4 or 5 days old. And it involved most of the lower part of my right leg. And he said, oh, the brown recluse spider, why didn't you come right away? We could have fixed that with some antibiotics and some intravenous. I'm thinking the same thing myself. But in any case, it went on for 4.5 months, and it was opened 5 times. And several different antibiotics and some x-rays because I thought I might lose the lower part of my leg. Well, what a perfect, ideal situation for an alcoholic. I had a wonderful alcoholic nurse neighbor who supplied me with a quart of scotch every day as I lay up in my king-size bed with the soaks on my leg, directing traffic as far as my children went, and playing the poor, pitiful me with my husband in Vietnam. And I played that for about 6 weeks. And then I got a little scared because I had seen my father hallucinate, and when the leg was getting a little better and I knew I had to shape up, I was afraid to stop drinking. That was my first clue that there might be problems there. I was such a good role model that I sent this neighbor to AA a whole year before I went. Now, I thought that she was really a bad alcoholic because she and her husband would get guns out and shoot each other, and they had would show me the bullet holes from last night. That was out of my league. But anyway, she made it a year before I did. So I did request hospitalization and some help, which I probably didn't need at that point. That was my first introduction to anybody in AA or actually talking to somebody about it. The doctor said, would you like to talk? I have a lady who has had some of the same problems drinking as you. Maybe it would do you some good to talk to her. So, you know, they have you at a disadvantage when they have you in bed and you're under their control. You kind of want to agree. And I said, okay. So this lady came and she talked to me and she told me this horrendous drunk log about she and her husband traveling cross country in the car with the kids and the dogs and leaving them in different towns, forgetting that they didn't have them with them until 500 miles down the road. And now it was just so wonderful to be sober, and the only way she could maintain her sobriety was to continue to work with these really sick alcoholics. And I thought, not me. I certainly didn't identify with that, and I wasn't ready. Sharp doctor wouldn't give me any sleeping pills, though, when I asked for a little assistance, and that was kind of forward thinking back in the 60s. In any case, he came back from Vietnam. We asked again for the Northeast or the North Central base, and we were sent to Las Vegas, Nevada. I said, please don't ask anymore for the Northeast or the North Central. We're going to be in Japan next. But in any case, I've come to love Las Vegas. I've lived there 19 years now, and he's gone on to other places, and I stayed. But my drinking at that point was no longer in control when the bottle was in my hand. Back in Arkansas, my husband had started to notice the amount that I was drinking. He noticed after one Christmas when people had given him 4 or 5 bottles of whiskey or whatever it was, but 4 or 5 bottles of hard stuff that had been put up in the cabinet. And I guess he went to fix somebody a drink, maybe himself, maybe a month or 6 weeks later, and none of them were there. And that was really very stupid of me to think that he wouldn't notice that, but who thinks at a time like that? He said, you're drinking an awful lot, aren't you? Don't you remember what happened to your mother? Well, of course I did, and that wasn't going to happen to me, and I'm working full-time, and she wasn't, and that was the answer. So that started the two-bottle game, and I don't know if any of you ladies have been married to non-alcoholic men, but once they give you the clue that they know there's a little bit too much going on, they are not quite as tolerant as some of the ladies are with alcoholic husbands. And so I played the two-bottle game, and that is the bottle he's watching me drink out of and the bottle you're actually drinking out of. You have to be a little sharp to do that. Because the level has to go down a little bit. He knows you're drinking something, and yet you have to keep enough in the other bottle. And I always say thank God for large Tide boxes. The county we were in Arkansas was a dry county, too, and you had to drive 6 miles one way or the other to hit a package store. And I want to tell you, I can remember some hairy rides and some badly written checks because my planning wasn't quite so. Of course, when he was in Vietnam, the controls were off, and I didn't have to be accountable, and I woke up many times, came to many nights, sitting in the living room, cigarette burns on my legs, the chair, the carpet, and two kids asleep in the rest of the house. Really, some of the things we go through, I think there has to be a God who looks over drunks and fools. He came back, the controls were on, we come to Las Vegas, and I get a more responsible job. I applied for a director of nurses job, and I was accepted. And about 5 months, so professionally I was still holding it together, and he had told me at that point that if I would just drink two beers a night, it would be okay. Well, all right. Made a big deal of that. I mean, if somebody tells you it's okay, you make a big deal of having your one beer pop in the top. Would you like a beer? No, I don't think I'll have one tonight, okay? And making sure that he knows it's only two every night that he sees. And if you do it real good, then you can reward yourself on the weekends for how well you did during the week. And it didn't take very long. There was one Sunday in February 1970 when I realized, once again, I was not going to be able to sober up in order to go to work. And I was the kind that called in. I didn't try to risk that kind of appearance at work. And I called the number in the personal column for Alcoholics Anonymous. And these two nice ladies came and spoke to me that afternoon. And I arrogantly continued to drink in front of them. Matter of fact, I sent one of my children for another beer. And they were so nice, and I wanted to be polite to them, that by the next day I'd gotten a little food in, and that still made me feel halfway human anyway. I said, yes, didn't want to disappoint them, I'll go to your meeting. So I went Monday night to a women's stag meeting with them, and I opened the door and walked in. It was in an old-fashioned women's recovery house, so of course it was all women. I walked in, about 90% of them were knitting or crocheting. I said, oh, it's that kind of club. No, I don't knit and I don't crochet. And there probably were three in the room that were knitting and crocheting in actuality. And very good members of AA, I was later to find out. Anyway, it was 3 days before Lent that year. And so I decided I'll give it up for Lent. So I gave it up for Lent, and I went every Monday night with these nice ladies to be polite to their Monday night meeting. And I don't really remember anything except the fact that they were not drinking. And somehow they seemed to be fairly satisfied with that. I tuned in when people talked about sick relatives other than alcoholism, or a friend. I have a friend who's dying of cancer or something like that. I could empathize with that. But I really didn't pick up much. Lent, as everybody knows, is 40 days long. And since I started my 40 days 3 days before Lent, you know, if you're an alcoholic, what my brain was saying 3 days before the end of Lent. It said, you have done your 40 days. You may try again. And I did. Equally unsuccessfully. Fortunately, it went rapidly downhill from there, and it was only to be a few more months. But one of the things, aside from the loss of respect for myself, the loss of dignity, the excuses, the wondering how I got myself to bed at night, because I certainly wasn't going to ask that husband. I should have known. He would have told me if he'd had to put me to bed. But that trying to cover all bases. And do you remember what you said last night? No, what the hell did I say last night? You know, kind of thing. Was really exhausting. And never really knowing. The kids, my son at that point was fairly young, and I don't know, his first impressions when I did sober up was, how come you don't keep beer in the refrigerator anymore, Mom? So I really don't know, other than I'm sure that he's the one carrying on the family disease, that there was a lot of effect there. There was a lot of effect on my daughter, who was 12 at that point, and who had been conceived and brought in at a time that really was not a good mature time for me. And I used her to kind of run the house, get your brother dressed, make sure he gets to school, bring me another beer, feed him breakfast, wash those dishes, that kind of thing. Knowing inside that that was not right. Such as paying back money or replacing a car because it was a material thing. Even if it was a lot of money, I had to settle for the fact the best I could do is not repeat any of that and make time count from then on. Sometimes kids are much better than we are as adults. During the last probably month or two, or just before that give up for Lent period, or maybe between that one and when I did sober up, I'm not sure. I'd have to ask her. Maybe she'll note on the mirror in my bedroom, and I had the bedroom situated then, so when you throw your legs out of bed, you're looking right at the mirror on the dresser. Now, I don't recommend that for any alcoholics. That's not the way to greet the morning. But that's the bedroom was small, and that's the way it was. And I did this one day after a terrible drinking in the bedroom the night before, and there was this note, this 12-year-old's handwriting, and it said, "Love is the most powerful force in the world. I love you dearly." I want to tell you that was cause for drinking that day, but I remembered it. I remembered it, and it set a seed in there that from what I had done, what I felt I had done and did, in fact, do or rob her from, that she still could love me and feel that way. And she's a delight today, and we have a good relationship, and it took me a while to get over the feeling that she wouldn't want me, because at one point in my life, I didn't want her. And we've been able to talk about it and have a real special relationship now. She is also a nurse. That's the other thing that runs on the female side of my family. And my sister's a nurse. And my daughter next week will be 30 years old. And I'm not letting her forget it, because she made comments about those older folks that are over 30. And I'm riding it for all it's worth. But we have a good relationship now. And she's a very special person to me, because I'm sure she bore the brunt of it. But in any case, it came to June of 1970, and once again, I couldn't get my act together, and it was a whole week of drinking. And at that time, if you have a responsible job and you're calling in sick a lot, they don't appreciate it. And my employer tell me, "We don't want you in your respective positions at the same time." Now, that kind of gets your attention. You know, most of us don't walk in here voluntarily just thinking it's a nice day, I think I'll check out AA. And certainly the pressure of those two things were what got me to really seriously do something. My husband said to me, "I don't care where you go. You are not staying here in the psychiatric ward, or you may go back to that house, that rehabilitation house where you went to those few AA meetings." Now, being a nurse, I've worked in the psych unit. I like the keys on my waist. Those of us who like to control things understand that. You know, I like to drive the car, and I wasn't real happy about flying a lot because I wasn't flying the plane. So that kind of control, I didn't want to go in there if they wouldn't give me the keys. But I said, all right, I'll go to the rehabilitation house. But in that point, back in 1970, you had to have, I think, 12 to 24 hours sobriety before you went in, because it wasn't a medical, it was just run by recovered alcoholics. And I remember hallucinating that night. I remember seeing a spider, a large spider, walk up the dresser in the bedroom. The only mistake I made was I asked my husband if he saw it, and of course he didn't. But I can bring that spider back into view anytime I want. I have not forgotten what that spider looked like. And there was a man that stood in the doorway every time I opened my eyes, and not my husband, he was sleeping, and this man or figure followed me to the bathroom and followed me back. And I made myself look at those things because I didn't want to see him again. And so far I haven't had to. Many people remember or look forward to their first sober holidays with a great deal of anticipation or real happy about it. I'm sure that my first sober holiday was good, but I don't remember it like my life was. That's the one I don't want to repeat. I can remember how terrible it was, having to pour the booze and the coffee to get going, to fix that dinner, to not be able to sit down and enjoy it with your family, and to know you've done it one more time. Disappointed them and you. And that's the one I remember. I've had, I'm sure, some good ones. I entered that house on June 20, and consider June 26, which is 24 hours without a drink for me. My 1970, my sobriety date, and so a couple of weeks ago I celebrated 18 years without a drink. Yeah. That's kind of special, because really now that's longer sober than drinking alcoholically, although all those personality traits were certainly there. If I'd added alcohol sooner, I'm sure I would have blossomed sooner. It's been quite a trip. It's been a fantastic trip. I was not the most open-minded, humble, willing person in that house when I first went in. I sent out vibes, I was told, that said, "Don't touch me or come near." And they didn't. Alcoholics are pretty perceptive. I was mad. I told my husband as he drove me up to the door, "You can pick me up tomorrow afternoon. I'll be fine." Sure you will. He tells me after that, that he had explained the rules, which was no contact with anyone, no phone calls, no working or anything for the first 2 weeks, and we prefer you stay 30 days. Now, I don't recall him saying that. He may have. I'm certainly didn't make a big deal of it if he did tell me. The house rules in those days were posted on a hot water heater that sat directly in front of the toilet. Every time you went to the bathroom, you read the house rules. So, you know, the first time I went to the bathroom, I read the house rules, and I read that, and I just bustled out of there and proceeded to tell the house mother that that was just about impossible for me to be gone from my world, my house, and whatever for 30 days, that they would not be able to survive without me. They didn't know how to run the washing machine. I wasn't sure even knew what brand of cereal to buy, and all those excuses that we're still trying to be different, those defenses that are up, that it really isn't a problem for us. And the doors weren't locked. I could have walked out. I didn't want to walk out. I wanted her okay, that I was different, and I could go. And, of course, I didn't get it, fortunately. There was a lady there, one of the first ladies I heard speak, who had more than 20 years sobriety, and at that point she was in her late 60s, I guess. One minute she said she had 20 years sobriety, I thought, this old broad never drank or she's lying. Because I just couldn't imagine 20 years without a drink. I just could not imagine it. And every time I opened my mouth to say, but I... You know, but I'm different, or I want, she would say no. And I thought, well, she just doesn't understand. Finally, I don't like to be wrong any more than anybody else. You only have to do that a couple of times, and I'll shut up and listen to what you say. So I shut up, and I listened. I've been told before that I have a kind of face that might look a little stern or unapproachable, and I certainly have never been that way. That's the face I was born with, and I heard somebody say, well, my insides are happy, it's just my face hasn't found out about it yet. And I have really worked in AA to try and overcome that and to be more approachable, because I don't feel that way inside, and I don't want to project that image anymore that I was projecting back then. And I had some very wise, slow teachers in AA in that house. There was one little lady who was the assistant house mother, who when a couple of the women in the house, there were 20, it could hold 22 women, and there was quite a variety of people in there, when they would get into an argument, well, I don't want to do this, I want to do that, and she'd just kind of shake her head and she'd say, I don't know why they fight it, he's going to get his way anyway, it's much easier to let him. And when my mind was going 500 miles an hour and what I'm going to do next or whatever, she taught me how to slow that down. She said, you know how to play solitaire? She said, sit down and play it in slow motion. Well, for an educated person, that's a rather simple, basic requirement. I mean, a little beneath your dignity. But I did it. And, you know, it worked. Because I had to concentrate so hard on slowing down playing solitaire that the thought process did slow down. So it was little things like that that sounded so hokey and so simple. And the steps, when I read them, and they said it's a simple program. Well, they did look days, maybe 12, one a day, and I can get it done. And we tolerate so many different kinds that come, and thank God we do. If you had asked me to admit I was an alcoholic at my first meeting or when I first went in, I don't know that I would have been able to do it. And I've heard of groups or houses like that that used to have, that they would require you to admit. Or even our own fellowship back in the founding days, they made the members time. Well, I wouldn't be here, would you? I couldn't conceive of that at that point. It took me a while to get that day at a time concept in my head. When I got it in and when I started trying some of the tricks that these ladies and had given me by their example, and I went to many, many step meetings in my first year, and I credit it for having a good foundation in AA. I really don't know what it would be like otherwise, because I didn't do it otherwise, but I recommend it when people say they're having problems. Go back and let it be repeated and repeated. This is a repetitious program. There's nothing new coming up. The steps are not changing. The steps and the people... coming, we have to keep reteaching it, and by doing that, by repeating what we went through and what I went through, I learn more by helping others do it. And it really is. We're not a goal-oriented society. We're not here to get 5 million members and then we can quit. We're a process-oriented society, and it is part of a process that I'm in. And if you can view your sobriety that way, or whatever you're doing in AA, or whatever you're not doing in AA, that way, that you are part of the process. Somebody very graphically told me what that meant one time and said, you picture a bucket full of water and you plunge your fist into the bucket of water. You know how much space it takes up, and you can stir it up, and you make a lot of waves, and you make a lot of noise in that bucket of water. And that, they said, imagine that's you. Now take your hand out, take your fist out of the water, and see how quickly it returns to its former state. That's how you should view yourself in AA. That cut me down to size. That's how important, it is a process. It is keeping the bucket full, if you would like, that we're part of. But in that, I learned about myself. And in the first 11 months of my sobriety, when I finally opened my ears and started emptying some of the junk, people come and say they're an empty vessel waiting to be filled. That was not me. I was a full vessel, and there was a lot of emptying and cutting through the garbage. And I started to try these things, and they worked. And I thought it was really simple, really easy. Thank God my higher power did not reveal everything to me in my first 11 months. I wondered why these people were having such a hard time when everything seemed so easy. At about 11 months, my husband decided then that probably a divorce was the best thing, that it wasn't working sober or drunk. That was my first crash off the pink cloud, because I thought I'd been a pretty sweet kid after I sobered up and still playing Superwoman at home. I had to start looking at some of what made me difficult to live with or not attractive or all-controlling kinds of things. And my ex-husband and I have an excellent relationship nowadays, but I was a little baffled back then because I thought it was going all right. One little clue as to what my personality or how sweet I might have been to live with is the fact that during the divorce, he had purchased some of the savings bond on the payroll savings plan where they took so much and every 3 months he got a $50 bond or whatever it was. They were all in serial numbers. He was to get those. And I looked up, they were at the house and he was back in England, looked up and sent him all the ones I could find, and there were some gaps. There were two or three numbers missing. I didn't remember cashing them. They were in his name, could have. But I had to write to him and say, I can't find 3 months here or 2 months there. I don't know where they are. I'll keep looking. If I find them, they're yours. He wrote back and he said, oh, don't worry about them. He said, I took them and cashed them. You were so tight with spending money that I never had anything to buy you Christmas or birthday presents with. I must have been a sweetheart. That was a little insight into character defect. I've had to learn to let go and let things happen. And, you know, in AA and in the group process, and I believe that the AA group is a big part of the process. The basic unit in AA is not us as individuals, but it's the group. As individuals, we wouldn't make it. The learning to watch that group process and not always having to speak up or always have things right or always have to have the answer has been a great teacher for me. Early in my sobriety, they asked me to be a secretary of a group. And I was only sober 2.5 months, and I had been listening enough then to know that it suggested 6 months, which I pointed out to them. They said, that's all right, we think you're responsible enough to show up every Tuesday. Well, I loved it. I loved that kind of responsibility. Maybe that's some of the nurse part of me coming out, to show up and bring the literature. And that was when many groups, the groups there anyway in Las Vegas, bought their own literature and carried it around with them. Now sometimes they don't. And it was the days, and I know this dates me, before styrofoam, where you had to wash the cups afterward. That was the secretary's duty, and it was kind of a badge of honor. If you could get the meeting place cleaned up and all the ashtrays and all the cups washed and put away in less than half an hour after the meeting. And it little things like that that were kind of competitive that made group secretaries feel good about what they were doing. And after that, the group secretary stint, I became an intergroup representative after attending as a guest secretary an intergroup meeting, and they required at least 1 year sobriety then, and I had less than a year when I attended this meeting, and it was one of those meetings where everybody is tearing their hair out, and the chairman is reading a letter of resignation, and the treasurer is bawling about the lack of money, and the secretary is reading what's wrong, and I thought, now I know why they want you to have a year's sobriety. I haven't attended one of those again, but it was quite an eye-opener, and our personalities can really come to the fore sometimes. Anyway, and from there I went on to some other group activities. And I did that because I was told very early, in the stage when I was willing to listen to whatever you said, that if a request was made of you in AA and you are able and willing to do it, you ought to say yes. And that if you are grateful for your sobriety and what it has done for you, then you owe AA something. And you owe them two things. You owe them time and money. Now, the money goes in the group basket or when you attend a meeting so that we can be self-supporting. And for a long time, the buck in the basket was very common. Fortunately, I see more and more people doing the two buck in the basket thing, because the buck of 15 or 18 or 20 years ago is not the same dollar today. And somebody opened my eyes to that. And the fact that even though I may not be at my home group last week, the group's expenses go on. So when I miss my home group meeting on a weekly basis, and sometimes I do miss it even though it's a Wednesday night, I make sure I pay the next week, because the group's expenses go on and my responsibility to keep the group going. And as far as time goes, serving as a secretary, intergroup rep, buying the literature, being available for 12-step calls, whatever it is, it's part of 12-step work. To carry the message, we have to make sure there is a message here to carry. And that means maintaining, they told me, a meeting place, being the intergroup rep, being the secretary or whatever, and to rotate, to let other people have these opportunities, that you don't keep it forever and become an expert or perfect in it. Speaking of perfect, I saw the perfect church today on our tour. I didn't know there was one. I knew the progress, but there is a church in town, for those of you that may not have seen it. It's called The Perfect. If I'd known about it earlier, who knows? But anyway, because the danger, the people who have all the answers in AA are not the currently serving SEC or GSR, because they allow us to serve just long enough to know what we should be doing. Now, it takes trustees a little longer. They have us for 4 years. We're a little slower. But just as we come to this idea, possibly, of just what we should have been doing, and it's time to rotate. So it is the has-beens that have all the answers. It is not the current ones. And that's the point for rotation. We don't need to be perfect. It does not have to be done my way to be right. Listen to what you're telling me. If you want to change the meeting format, or you want to let somebody in, or you don't want to let them in, or shall they speak for 20 minutes, or shall they speak for 10 minutes? Because if I shut up long enough to listen, I find that frequently the decision that comes out is what I would have tried to force the group to do to begin with. And if it doesn't, that's okay. There are really no emergencies in AA. We take a long time to make our decisions, and there isn't any need to immediately right or wrong, and it isn't set in concrete. And if you make a wrong decision, you can change it. I've watched groups who have deliberately and knowingly broken traditions. And, you know, we're not a punitive body. I can't go tear up their membership. And my answer to people who are is there is, if they know what, understand the traditions, and they understand what they've done, leave them alone for a while. Because if they truly have AA's good at heart, they will conform and become a good AA group among themselves. And if they don't, they'll fade away and die, and you won't have to worry about the group. But you don't have to, it's like a sore. You don't have to keep picking at it and keeping it. You know, we alcoholics don't like to be told you have to do something. And I've seen that happen more than once with groups. Now, it may take them 6 or 9 months to die, but people realize that that's not a correct AA group. It takes care of itself. This last year we had, and people are still talking about it, you know, talk about our singleness of purpose. We have a program for the recovery from alcoholism. We have a set of steps that were given to us over 50 years ago from all different areas. They weren't brand new. And we have been very generous and shared them with many other fellowships, over 100 others. I don't know how many are still active, but if you have another problem, there's got to be another fellowship out there for you with over 100 of them. And one of them is called Problems Anonymous, so if you can't put it in any of the others, you certainly can put it in that one. I don't know why I would be very afraid to try and change my message of what I received when I came, which is love and tolerance and a way to recover from alcoholism on a one-day-at-a-time basis. And to know that the higher power, for me, is not a person or anything that my little mind has learned or conceived on its own, that it is a power much greater than myself. Frequently, I can see it and feel it in groups like this. But it's not a screening process. It doesn't mean that you stand at the door and ask for a blood test to make sure they're alcoholic, because a lot of us wouldn't have made it into the room. But and certainly we're generous. It doesn't matter what any other problem is. If you have a problem with alcohol, you have a desire to stop drinking, you belong here. It's as simple as that, as far as I can tell. It doesn't matter what else is wrong. If all of us were perfect, it would be a very small membership. Or pure alcoholic. I like to say to the purists that my drugs of choice nowadays are nicotine and caffeine. If you're not totally sober, if you're not off all things, is this bottled water or are there chemicals in this? They are kind of a rubber cement that you used to be able to make little balls out of and stretch or whatever. You used to be able to pull them apart. Have a little group that goes off here on its own and does its own thing. And maybe it comes back and maybe it doesn't. But if it comes back, it again becomes part of the whole. And they are not laws, and we're not a punitive body. We have succeeded so far, I think, by love and tolerance. It's true of me. I was not lovable or tolerable in the beginning. And people like you and people that were here before me are the ones that allowed me to be whatever I had to be until I realized what I... My son is the one that's probably... I passed on the disease, not only I, but all my relatives before me. And I believe that because I've seen him get into a couple of wrecks with his motorcycle, and they're not normal. When he was about 3 years old and we were living in Albany, Georgia, he started, went by knocking on the neighbors' doors. He told the neighbors, do you have a cookie? So you can imagine after about 10 more years of practice with that kind of con, what I was getting as a teenager. And it got to the point where every time I opened my mouth, I was yelling no at him, and there was really absolutely no control whatsoever. Personality-wise, we're kind of alike. And so I made amends to my ex-husband, and I sent him his problem 15-year-old to straighten out. And it worked. But I'm sure that he's still in the practice, and he doesn't drink every day. He's not drunk every day. He's fairly responsible. He's a lot of fun to be with. But I see some of the signs there. And the motorcycle accident that I that comes to mind the most is the one in California where really lucky he didn't break his neck, but he messed up a knee, laid his motorcycle down on the side and scraped up this knee. And I said to him, well, how fast were you going? He said, oh, I don't know, 35 or 40. And I said, and what was the posted speed limit? And he said, 15. And I said, well, and he said, well, it was a hairpin turn off the freeway. He said, if the California Highway Department had made that road right, it wouldn't have happened. Now, I understand that kind of thinking. So that's where I get my suspicions from. But whether he ever makes it or not, and I certainly pray that he does, or whether your relatives ever make it or not, and I certainly pray if they need it, that they do make it. I feel an obligation to make sure that this program continues. I think that if it disappeared tomorrow, if AA disappeared tomorrow, you and I might stay sober. We have gotten the message. Might. Loners do it on their own. But what would we be doing to generations yet to come? I feel an obligation to continue to have available for the people after me what they had available for me. And that is why I continue to be available and willing and serve Alcoholics Anonymous. And a very selfish reason, very selfish, is that I can't remember the last time I saw a state officer or a delegate or even a past one go out and get drunk. If you're busy getting out of yourself, I've found I feel better. I get the rewards. It's not what I can do for AA, even though my brain will still occasionally tell me what it does for me, what I learn from serving other people. It's been a delight to be with you. It's a distinct honor to serve you and our fellowship, and I encourage everybody who can try it to do it. It will certainly enhance your sobriety and our fellowship, and I thank you.